Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On March 18, 2008, the court heard oral arguments in District of Columbia v. Heller. The court was asked to consider whether the D.C. gun ban violates the Second Amendment rights of individuals who are not affiliated with any state-regulated militia, but who wish to keep handguns and other firearms for private use in their homes. Kevin Marshall of Jones Day discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Attorney Marshall.
The Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution provides that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Surprisingly, the Supreme Court has yet even to sketch the outlines of this prominent part of the Bill of Rights. That is about to change. In District of Columbia v. Heller, a case that challenges the nation's most restrictive gun laws. The Supreme Court heard oral argument on March 18th, and a decision is expected by the end of June. The Second Amendment's path to the court has been delayed for several reasons. Soon after the Civil War, the court held that the 14th Amendment did not directly apply the Second Amendment to the states, and has not had occasion to reconsider that view since it developed its incorporation doctrine after World War I. Before the Civil War, three state Supreme Courts did apply the Second Amendment to state laws, one even striking down a law, but the U.S. Supreme Court had no occasion to review those decisions. Moreover, there was no federal regulation of private firearms until 1934, and after federal regulation began, and the Supreme Court in 1939 issued its Delphic decision in United States v. Miller, declining to find that a sawed-off shotgun was a protected arm, lower courts for over 60 years all agreed in reading the amendment as not securing to individuals a personal right to keep and bear arms. Rather, they generally read it as granting to states a right to maintain militias. So, there was no disagreement that the Supreme Court needed to resolve. Amid this consensus, the District of Columbia in 1976 effectively banned the ownership of handguns and also required that rifles or shotguns at all times be unloaded and disabled, either disassembled or secured with a trigger lock. The ground started to move soon after, however, as a scholarly debate arose over the existing consensus. The judiciary joined the debate in 2001, when the Fifth Circuit, in United States v. Emerson, concluded that the amendment does secure a personal right of individuals. But the court upheld the federal law in question, and the Supreme Court declined review. The same year, the U.S. Justice Department generally adopted Emerson as its litigating position in a memorandum from Attorney General Ashcroft to all U.S. attorneys. The Attorney General saw no conflict between an individual right view and the Department's ability to defend existing federal gun laws. Drawing on Emerson, he explained that the amendment allows reasonable restrictions of two particular types: to prevent unfit persons from possessing firearms, or to restrict possession of firearms particularly suited to criminal misuse. The Department followed this in 2004 with a full opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel, reiterating and expounding the individual right view. About this time, D.C. resident Dick Heller and five other residents challenged the D.C. gun laws as violating the Second Amendment. Their limited challenge avoids any question regarding the scope of a right to bear arms. The divided D.C. Circuit sided with Heller in 2007, adopting the individual right view and interpreting the amendment as protecting the keeping of arms for private self-defense, among other things. The court, much like Emerson and the Attorney General, endorsed what it called reasonable restrictions, which it described as restrictions that either are drawn from the common law or facilitate a well-regulated militia, and that do not impair the core conduct that the amendment protects. It held that handguns were protected arms under Miller, particularly given their widespread use for home protection, and that, regardless of what restrictions might be reasonable, the district at least could not flatly ban the keeping of a handgun in the home, or the keeping and defensive use there of a functional firearm. The Supreme Court, in accepting review of the case, framed the question as whether the D.C. laws violate the Second Amendment rights of individuals who are not affiliated with any state-regulated militia, but who wish to keep handguns and other firearms for private use in their homes. The District of Columbia does not argue the pure collective right position, that the Second Amendment grants a right to states. It concedes that individuals have a right under the amendment, but would limit that right to action in connection with the state's militia. Others have labeled this view a quasi-collective right or sophisticated collective right view. The district emphasizes the reference to the militia in the amendment's preamble, contends that the phrase bear arms has only a military meaning and colors the meaning of keeping arms, and argues that the amendment responded to fears that Congress would use its broad enumerated powers over militias to disarm them. The district argues in the alternative that its laws are permissible even if the Second Amendment secures a personal right. It contends that such a right remains subject to reasonable restrictions and takes a much broader view of what is reasonable than did the D.C. Circuit, Emerson, or the Attorney General. The district's primary contention is that the legality in D.C. of possessing rifles and shotguns in the home, even with the restrictions on storage, satisfies any right of keeping guns for self-defense, particularly given that the district considers handguns specially dangerous. Heller responds that the amendment's operative text, recognizing the right of the people to keep and bear arms, plainly secures a personal right, that the preamble is consistent with such a right because private arms ownership facilitates a traditional citizen militia, and that, in any event, a preamble cannot negate operative text. He, like the district, finds further support in the historical context, invoking early Americans' understanding of their right as Englishmen to have arms for self-defense, their experience of citizen militias and disarmament in the American Revolution, and the First Congress's rejection of a separate amendment expressly protecting the state's authority over their militias. Heller follows the D.C. Circuit in contending, based on both history, including the 1792 Militia Act, and current common usage, that handguns are protected arms, and that whatever regulations the Second Amendment allows, it at least prohibits a ban on keeping such a protected arm or keeping a functional firearm. Heller therefore sees no need for the court to wade into the general standard of review for regulations. He argues, however, that if the court does get into that, then regulations of the gun right, which is explicit in the Constitution, should face strict scrutiny, under which, to be constitutional, a regulation must be narrowly tailored to serve a compelling governmental interest. The Justice Department filed a friend of the court, or amicus brief, that tried to split the difference. Consistent with the department's position since 2001, the Solicitor General endorsed a personal individual right. But he then implicitly disavowed the department's position since 2001 on the scope of permissible restrictions, a position that in 2002 the department had described to the court as strict scrutiny. Drawing on election law, he argued for what he called heightened scrutiny, under which important regulatory interests would justify reasonable restrictions. He urged the court to remand for application of this new standard. The Solicitor General worried that the D.C. Circuit's holding, rejecting a ban on a protected arm, would, when joined to Miller's suggestion that a gun is a protected arm if appropriate for militia use, threaten some federal gun laws. He was particularly worried about the 1986 ban on new machine guns, given that certain machine guns are standard issue for infantry. Heller responded that, if the SG cannot determine without a remand that the nation's most draconian gun laws are unconstitutional, then his standard has no practical difference from the district's. He also pointed to Emerson's 7-year-old standard as having worked no harm to federal gun laws. The court received an avalanche of other amici briefs, with 19 supporting the district to one degree or another, and almost 50 supporting Heller. The most notable politically was a brief supporting Heller filed by a majority of U.S. representatives and a majority of senators, including Dick Cheney in his capacity as President of the Senate. The Vice President thus publicly disagreed with his own administration. The oral argument on March 18th was active and extended well beyond its allotted time. There was discussion of the nature of the right, but the justices seemed more interested and how they might determine the scope of permissible regulation. Many sought guidance from the pre-founding English right. This was a bit surprising, given that the parties in their briefs essentially ignored that source of authority. Several of the amici briefs, however, do discuss it. Justice Kennedy, commonly considered the swing vote, appeared throughout to have sympathy for a personal right to keep arms for defense against intruders in the home, as he put it, and for reading the preamble as reaffirming the importance of a militia, but not affecting one way or the other the right that the operative text sets out. To the extent that Miller's reliance on the preamble might expand the scope of protected arms beyond those appropriate for individual self-defense, Kennedy even seemed open to narrowly reading or otherwise disregarding that precedent. The Chief Justice seemed inclined to avoid the question of intricate and judicially developed levels of scrutiny and decide the case narrowly. He thought the court might evaluate the restrictions here by reference to the restrictions that were accepted at the time of the founding, and thus hold that a total ban on possession of a handgun is not reasonable. Justice Alito, challenging the Solicitor General, similarly wondered how a ban on possession of the type of weapon that's most commonly used for self-defense, an obvious basis for distinguishing handguns from machine guns, could survive under any standard of review. The Chief Justice and others also seemed, however, open to the possibility that some safety requirements such as a trigger lock could be permissible. Justices do not play all of their cards at oral argument, and they may bluff, so it is hard to make predictions. But oral argument does suggest that a majority is inclined to recognize a personal right and strike down at least D.C.'s handgun ban, but on narrow grounds. They also may strike down D.C.'s storage restrictions, or leave an opening for safety regulations that do not interfere with effective use in an emergency. So, a remand regarding trigger locks is not unimaginable. Justice Breyer seemed characteristically open to deferring to legislative judgments about the need for and reasonableness of regulation, and thus to a position somewhere near where the Justice Department now is, recognizing a personal right, giving wide leeway for restrictions, and to upholding the D.C. laws. He also may have noticed that Justice Kennedy did not directly engage the question of whether rifles and shotguns could suffice to make effective a right to keep arms for home defense. Justices Stevens, Souter, and perhaps Ginsburg seem open to the district's militia-related interpretation of the amendment. Whatever the scope of any decision recognizing a personal right, it likely will open a floodgate for follow-up decisions. Courts will, among other things, have to consider whether the doctrine of incorporation requires that the Second Amendment apply to the states. Thus, Heller is both the end of one journey and likely the beginning of another.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.